Inuit from living in Mordialloc from 1932 until wartime. And 1938, the end of 1938, I got a permanent job in the Herald office, and in less than a year, September 39, the war declared, and I thought, just start to get going after the depression, and think the war, and of course you think, oh, this is, it's all going to happen in the next 5 minutes, but it takes, as everyone knows, about 5 years to get into the war and finish it, and it's 5 years out of the lives of a lot of young people in those days. It was, whereas out of the life, we got a lot, the ones that survived got a lot out of it, and lots of waste there. So in August 41, that was before the Japanese came into the war, I'd gone into the army and they'd called, I couldn't get in the Air Force, but they were calling up people for the, they called the militia, which was for Australian Defence only. They were commonly known as chocolate soldiers. And I remember being up at, we went into camp near Seymour, and when we started there, they wanted someone for the intelligence section, the eye section, for doing mapping and so forth, and I was pretty gifted, I think, in drawing, so I thought I'd go in the eye section. So they said, oh, well, you know, now you've got to do about 6 weeks of training with the NCO's cadre. They had these young fellows to be known as, to be known, you know, to be corporals and sergeants and so forth. So I went there for a crash course in, you know, rifle and drill and so forth. And after about a month, I was speaking to the chap in the intelligence section, and I'd mentioned that I'd been trying to get in the Air Force, and he said, oh, in that case, we'll scrub you because we're not going to, you know, teach you, have you here, then you walk away into the Air Force. And I thought, oh, in that case, I'll just, well, pull out of this NCO's cadre. But the chief of that says, oh, no, he recognised foreman material or corporal material. So he said, oh, no, you've got to finish it now. So I finished and did the exams. And because I wasn't very concerned about being a corporal, I just flew through. And they we had examinations and so forth. And they lined us all up, about probably about 40 fellas. And a few of them didn't get anywhere, but there's a few Lance Corporals, and then they said, Corporal Newitt and C Company, that was a company I was in, so I wasn't going to lose my mates. And it was a matter of 7 shillings a day in those days for privates, or 10 and 6 a day for the corporal. So the 3 and 6 per day was quite a nice rise, and I thought, well, I'm not losing my mates, so I accepted the corporal stripes, and we spent the next year training. But we'd gone to Albury not long after this, and it was still before the Japanese came in. It would have been October, and the Japs came in November, as you know, and in October they wanted a volunteer corporal from our company to go to New Guinea and for Australian Defence. And there's two of us rushed up to the office as soon as the parade was finished. There's two of us rushed to the office. There's Ron McWhorter. I always remember how Bill White pulled out a coin, tossed it in the air, and said, oh, well, you lose, Ken. McWhorter wins. He's going to New Guinea. Well, it was the worst win he ever had, that fellow, because finished up in the 39th Battalion, and that was the first lot of chocolate soldiers to stop the Japanese on the Owen Stanley Ranges, the Kokoda Trail. So apart from being the first to come in contact with the Japanese, his service life would have been much rougher than mine, because he was in the mud and the jungle and the dengue fever and mosquitoes and things, whereas I'd kept on training up past, up as far as Maryborough, and mainly we were down at Beenleigh, this side of Brisbane, on the south side of Brisbane, and we found out later we were the Brisbane line. In other words, had the Japanese got to Australia, it was the line they were going to try and hold us at the Brisbane line. So, and we'd, the young people today don't realise just how close we were to being invaded by the Japs. It was only, in my mind anyway, the American Navy and our own that stopped them at the Battle of Midway, and, you know, to be able to had they got a decent footing on Australia, they would have taken a lot of getting out. Anyway, while training there at Beenleigh, it was, I had this foot, papillome, I suppose you'd call it, infection, but, and on my second try at hospital to get it cut out, I remember that having a look and said to the doctor, no, you're not deep enough yet, that's the same as last time. Anyway, they cut it out further, then put a sort of bandage on it that made it feel so good that I went dancing in Brisbane, and one day I was going in by tram, and our captain looked across the tram beckoned me to get in his jeep and says, we're going up north, Corporal, what's doing? I said, oh, well, you know, the army, they're going to send me way down to Gundawindi, which is 200 miles away back from Brisbane to be sorted out. While there, the Air Force came around recruiting, and they said anyone without a leaving certificate need not apply. Well, I thought, you don't carry your leaving certificate around your pocket, at least it's a day out in Gundawindi. So there was eight of us went into Gundawindi, and they accepted three of us, and I think the other fellows must have been a bit, either didn't have their leaving certificate or they just didn't have, anyway, I did have a couple of stripes, and I remember the officer saying, well, the fact you've got a couple of stripes must mean you've got a bit of grey matter, but I don't know really, it was just one of those things that I said, so what happens now? He says, you're in the Air Force. I said, but I'm still in khaki. He said, we'll catch up to you. So it wasn't long after I sent up to Miraburra, and when I got there, all my mates had gone on up to New Guinea, so if I hadn't have been in hospital, I would have gone to New Guinea then. So it wasn't very long after the Air Force came out there to recruit, and I helped put the Army fella through into the Air Force. And I was one of the first to go from the Army to Air Force. So when I got home to go into the Air Force, I had none of my clothing fitted me after a year. It's amazing what a year in the Army would do for a young 19, 20-year-old. They really built up. So I had to go into the Air Force at Shepparton in my Army uniform. And I don't know whether I got special treatment in coming from the Army, but the Air Force was able to get rid of this papilloma. They burnt it out with some acid of some kind. And I went from there to Summers for initial training, and of course I hadn't been to school for about 7 years, leaving school at 14, and some of the young fellas just flew through the maths and electrical science and things like that, but I didn't have a clue, and I had to really study. In fact, I had one of my friends, a school teacher, and on the initial exams I failed in half of them, and I should have been into the cookhouse and that's that, but they did have some supplementary examination, so I got this school teacher friend to help me with my maths and electrical science and did extra exams and just scraped through. So we then get sent up to at Parkes. They sorted out whether you were going to be navigator, pilot, wireless operator, etc. So they gave us an aptitude test for pilots and so forth, but anyway, I finished up going. On the march out, we were going up to Parkes to do a wireless operator's course, which took 6 months and a hell of a waste of time, but that's where we were sent. But when we were being sent, I made myself known to Hubert Hopman, who was an instructor down there, physical training, and we had a mutual friend, a bike rider, and I'd been racing a bit, and Hoppy said to me, are you happy to be going to Parkes? I said, I would have rather gone to Canada, because quite a few of them were detailed to go to Canada. And Hoppy said, why didn't you ask me? I said, oh, I think I remember them saying, oh, well, I'll just go with the flow sort of thing, whatever, you know. So during the 6 months at Parkes, my school teacher friend was up there with us, and we're to learn Morse, to be able to take Morse, the 25 words a minute, as fast as you can write, really, or print, and to be able to even listen to somebody else talk at the same time. I used to think you had two heads to do that, but it's possible. But there's some people couldn't get past this 8 words a minute. I believe that's a mental block. So we had this chap we nicknamed Irk McComb, little chap with rosy cheeks and a good little friend anyway. He and quite a few others just couldn't take this Morse code, so they said, right, well, you can just go on the straight air gunners, which meant they didn't have to sit there for another 4 months learning how to take Morse code and pull a radio to bits more or less and keep it going. So with that, it put them 4 or 5 months ahead of us, the straight air gunners. And I don't think any of them survived. I can't. Yes, I do. Yes, I can think now of two of them that did survive, but most of them, because they were 4 or 5 months ahead, they just got the chop, as they said. Most of them, they were all sent to England, except one chap. He broke his leg and he kept home in Australia, but the rest of them went to England. But to think this little fellow, Erky, as we were known, so it would have been probably nearly a year later that I was on a bus travelling somewhere, and I always remember a fellow named Payne had a funny sort of laugh and said, oh, Pop, I'd nickname of Pop with a photo stage. He said, had this funny sort of laugh, did I hear about your mate? I said, which one? He said, Erky, he's got blown to bits, you know, direct hit on the cookie. And it, you know, seemed a bit sick for people listening, but I think as I've heard about other people saying, you know, that I never went into trench warfare, but when the fella next year got shot, it was so close, it was sort of a something not well, to be horrified, but to also have a sort of a not a laugh about, but it's just something that sort of, well, how lucky am I that much, and it wouldn't have happened. So anyway, when they got to England, we went down to Brighton, where they sorted us out there, and there again we went to near Manchester, and we lined up one day, and a fella come along, and my other friend McNamara, we lined up more or less alphabetically, and this, they come along and chopped off about 20, and between McNamara and Newitt, they put the hand and said, all right, you blokes to my left to Canada, you fellas here, the first three, you go down to Oxford. There's a little satellite station there, and you're going down there to be Wattis operators to fly in Oxford with Sprog pilots who had just got their wings, and we had to go down there and be staff and fly with these Sprog pilots at night time for their twin engine training in Oxford. So this is where I say that luck or providence comes in so much, because there's one thing I liked about it, it's just being in England early on, and we had quite a few of the English pilots, now all officers, or most of them are officers, they got commissioned off course, but they'd for their wireless operator to go with them in case they got lost, which happened pretty often, they'd, when you're ready, sir, and I like being called sir by these Sprog pilots. But one night I got an Australian fellow, I've forgotten his name, but we were flying in fairly thick cloud, but I remember looking out to my right and right and above us, and I said, what's that out there? Cloud, it seemed to be a whole lot more dark blue than the rest of the cloud. And he glanced across and says, yeah. And then the penny dropped and he started climbing like mad. He said, I forgot to set my altimeter. You know, they set the altimeter above sea level, and we were flying along a valley, just waiting to run out of a valley. And it's just, you know, when you chance remarks like that, it sort of make you think, well, no, I'm not fireproof, but boy, that could have happened, you know. And then when while we were at Oxford, we had what they called airport defence, and we had some rifle shooting. And because I'd been in the army, and I was about the third best in 1,000 place, because Dad was a good rifle shot, and I thought, well, seeing his, I better be good. So we have this rifle shooting in at Oxford, and of course I'm way above most of them there, and a squadron leader who had a very burnt face sort of took to me, and Aussie who knew what he's doing with the rifle and so forth. And I think it was the first time I was ever asked would I like to in the Air Force. It was always just detailed to this. The squadron leader asked me would I like to fly with him up to Scotland, because he wanted to have his first flight after being badly burnt. This was his nerve, getting his nerve back flight up to Scotland. So, of course, even though it was an invitation and not an order, I said, oh, yes, no worries. So just the two of us. So So we're flying above cloud, and everything's just so peaceful. And then you see this one peak of, I don't know what, mountain sticking up through the cloud. And it seemed, you know, a queer thing to have this. I felt as though we're crabbing towards us all the time. I felt like saying, come on, get away with it. And all of a sudden, there's three young Americans flying Thunderbolt aircraft. Says, this is a mouse, let's play with it. And they went, if I had have had my trailing aerial out, and I'm sure they would have gotten mixed up with it. They flew around us like bees around a pot, you know. And all this fellow could do, who'd been really through it, was sit and fly straight and level and hope they'd go away, which they did. But eventually did, but I mean, it was one of those things at a time I thought, boy, these young fellas that want to see how close they can go without hitting. Anyway, I think what you want is things like this, things that happen, and, you know, I'm going along thinking that we get to a place called Morton in Marsh, and there's something that a lot of people have heard about, much bonding in the marsh. It's Jimmy Edwards and some comedians at the time. They had this